That means we're ready to go. Peter will talk about the Dvorak. You'll probably see some of the things that aren't in your program. That's the whole idea. Remember last February, we didn't have any program, so you had to really listen. But I'll start with the Mendelssohn, and there's a story here. As I'm sure many of you know, when the Metropolitan Opera Orchestra and the opera, 1 o'clock on Saturdays in New York, it's 10 o'clock out here in the theaters. And you go out there, theater, listen to the opera, you got a front row seat, you get to be in on all the interviews between acts. They can even show pictures of the orchestra. Coming in from the side, you can see everybody in the orchestra. And of course, if you're in the Met, you don't get to see any of that. So here I am, I'm looking, I'm seeing that person there, one of those four people, one of those associate principal concert masters, is Laurie Hamilton. And I thought, oh, how good. I guess no more than 2 years ago, she came out to Livermore, she's a Livermore girl, and dropped into the rehearsal. I'm thinking, ah, yes, yes, maybe she can get off from doing duty at the Met, and they all can if they're flexible, and have her come and play with us. Last time she played was the President of Fairgrounds. We did an all Tchaikovsky concert, and she played the Tchaikovsky violin concerto. Ah, good, 25 years ago. Boy, it was hot. And I said, yeah. She said, yeah, sure, I'd like to play. I'll rearrange my schedule. I said, well, let's see. And I had in mind, because we had somebody who was going to do the Sibelius violin concerto and got sick and couldn't do it, and I just would love to have done that again. We had done it once before, a long time ago, with Lucy. Helene, help me out. Stalzman, Lucy Stalzman, who was associate concertmaster with the San Francisco Symphony. And that was a wonderful experience. So I asked her, would you want to do the Sibelius? And she says, you know, the concerto for violin that all violinists will die to play is the Mendelssohn. Fine, great. Now, what about Mendelssohn? Mendelssohn, like Mozart, was a wunderkind. Both of them, before they got in their teens, they were writing and playing, composing, steeped in the music. Of course, the big difference, Mozart was poor, and Mendelssohn had all the cultural advantages. Of course, it's 100 years later, but it took him a while to write the concerto. Although he was very facile in writing, he was very busy doing other things, not only composing, not only performing, but conducting. And where he could find the time to write was a little problematical. Nowadays, so many composers are attached to the university and they have time, providing if they'll teach their students to compose, they have time then to compose at the university's expense. But no universities then, and you had to just do the best you can. And these, some of these stories are wonderful as to how and why they just kept after it and at it. Failure after failure after failure. Mendelssohn didn't have any failures. He just flew right from the first day. And like Mozart, died before he was 40. The concerto, he had to have help. Quite often composers who are not violinists do ask a leading performer, let's see, how do you think about this? How would this, well, that's pretty hard. I'll just adjust a few notes. Oh yeah, that's a lot better. And I'm gonna tell you a story about that. In December, Stuart Keenan, who was the former San Francisco Concertmaster. He's going to be playing the Brahms violin concerto in our first concert in December. Come and hear that. One of the hardest things about the Brahms is that the cadenza is so hard. And I was asked 10, 15 years ago to write a substitute cadenza for this person that was going to be performing it. And so I asked Stuart, would you mind performing this? I've never had it recorded. I'd like to hear it. So I was over to dinner with him 2 or 3 weeks ago, and he took me through the cadenza, and he said, I'd like to change this here, and I'd like to alter that there. But right, I'm sure he did. But he didn't change too much, so I felt good about that. Mendelssohn had the virtuoso violinist of the day, Ferdinand David, consulted with him, and this is what he came up with. And the interesting thing about this concerto, unlike some of the other concertos, no introduction, no orchestra playing for a while and introducing the themes and then the violin gets the way. No, starts right off with the violin. And that's it. Right into it. Slow movement, song movement, and the last movement goes like the wind. In fact, at rehearsal Tuesday night, we got through, we went pretty well straight through it, and I said, anything you want to comment on? She says, can you play the first and third movements faster? I thought it was pretty fast right away. Great, so we'll do it. And you'll hear it in this fast version tonight.
Well, so the Dvorak that we are going to do tonight is one of his lesser-known symphonies, but there is every reason that it should be as well-known, at least as the New World Symphony. A little bit about Dvorak. He was and still is the premier Bohemian composer of world history. He was born in a humble family in Prague. His father was a butcher and an innkeeper, and he said, you know, chopping meat and doing sheets, you know, I'm not gonna do that, I have talent. So he managed to get into an organ school in Prague, and he was very good at organ. He also played viola, and was able to secure a position as the church organist in the largest cathedral in Prague. And this allowed him the flexibility and freedom then to be able to devote his talents to composition. His first major hit was the Slavonic Dances, and we've played those recently. It's a great suite of music. And what set the stage for that was the success of Brahms a few years before when he premiered his Hungarian Dances. And Brahms, of course, being the premier composer in the 1870s, he's writing in Vienna. Vienna is the capital of the Austrian Empire. You don't write anything unless it's in German. You don't do anything, any culture, unless it's Germanic. But Brahms is able to do whatever he wants because he has the clout of being Brahms. So he writes music from Hungary, and that then sets the stage for Dvorak a few years later then to write his first suite of Slavonic Dances. And it's a big hit, and so Dvorak, in fact, is able to become friends with Brahms, and the two of them maintain a friendship that lasts for the remainder of their careers. And Brahms is able to open doors for Dvorak that would otherwise be closed. Dvorak eventually is able to go to London, where he is given the rare privilege of conducting concerts that consist completely of his own music. Usually that doesn't happen early in one's career, but Dvorak certainly had a lot of talent. And he is invited to Moscow by Tchaikovsky. He's a big success there as well. And eventually he comes to the United States. In 1892, he is given the post of being the first conductor of the National Conservatory, which eventually becomes the New York Philharmonic. And he stays in New York City for 3 years. And then in 1895, he goes back to Prague. He's had enough of the New World. He's written a lot of great music, but he misses his homeland. And he spent the remainder of his time in Prague and dies in 1904. Well, so the setting for all of this then is his Sixth Symphony is actually the first one that he wrote. Why is it number six? Well, this is one of these confusing things that happens when you have publishers getting involved. And what happened was Dvorak actually numbered his symphonies in the order that he wrote them, but they were numbered by his publisher in the order that they were published. And there's one of the things that always happens when you have business people getting involved in the arts, which is they will also fiddle with the opus numbers as well. Because if you are a young composer and you don't have any conducting or composition experience behind you, your publisher, even if he knows that you've got good music, will often give you a higher opus number just so that people who are going to buy your music will say, oh, well, he's not a beginner. He's a professional. This is opus number 40, even though it was his first symphony. So they play games like that all the time. And of course, the music business has not changed in many centuries. There are always people with talent, and there are always people who profit from the people with talent. So that continues. So Dvorak wrote the Sixth Symphony in 1880, and it's very Czech in its style. He is writing a lot of folk music. He's familiar with all the Bohemian styles. The Furient, the third movement, is of course a scherzo, which is a Czech dance. And your notes talk about this at length. But Dvorak is interested really in a lot of more fundamental things in his whole approach to composition. He is interested in what he calls indigenous music. And for him, the form that this takes is when he's still in Bohemia, he writes a lot of folk songs, he arranges a lot of folk songs, and he writes a lot of original music in his own style of folk music. But he's really concerned about the music that you grow up with. The folk songs have come down, only the good songs are actually passed on, the lousy ones are forgotten. And in fact, he writes a lot of choral music to begin with. He's very fascinated with the choral style. And one of the first successful suites of songs that he wrote was aptly titled Songs My Mother Taught Me. And this suite is actually still sung, if you are fluent in Czech. But the music is well known amongst vocalists, and it's part of the repertoire. So when Dvorak comes to the United States, then he is interested also in American music. Well, what is that? In 1890s, there is not really a national form of any kind, and Dvorak spends his time listening to the indigenous music of the United States. Well, that, of course, is largely the Negro spirituals of the antebellum South. It is the Native American melodies. And in fact, when he writes his famous Symphony No. 9 from the New World, the flute solo in the first movement is an imitation of the Song of Hiawatha. So these are the things that he brings into his composition, and it actually causes problems for him with his New York patrons, because he is interested in all of this you know, native music. But New York high society, you know, doesn't kind of look at that as open-mindedly as Antonin is looking at that, and that's one of the reasons why he eventually goes back to Prague. So, in any case, I have to tell you this one story, and this really speaks to who Dvorak was as a composer, but also about the power of music itself, the spiritual power of music. And the story is this. Many of you may know this story, but I'll relate it again because it's a powerful one. The setting is 1942 in the Pacific Islands, and the European settlers of all of the Pacific Islands are fleeing the advancing Japanese invasion. And a group of Dutch settlers in Java board a freighter to India. The ship is torpedoed by the Japanese, and half the crew and half the passengers die. The survivors are picked up by the Japanese Navy and are taken to Sumatra, where they spend the remainder of the war in a prison camp. And the hero of this story is a woman named Margaret Dryburgh. She is British, she is a Presbyterian missionary, and she knows that If the spirit dies, the body dies. And so she sets it her goal then to be able to do something with this women's prison that she is in that will allow them all to survive the atrocities of the war. And one of the challenges that she has is that in this prison with 300 women, half of them are Dutch and half of them are Australian or British. So they don't have a common language. But of course, Dryburgh, being a musician, knows that music is the common language. And so she sets out and transcribes from memory, by hand, a number of famous classical pieces, and produces all of these in four-part harmony, SATV, which she then finds vocalists inside the camp to actually sing these parts. And she basically writes up individual parts for each of the four groups. She rehearses them individually. And in December of 1943, they have their first concert. The audience is the other prisoners in the camp. And they sing, and this is the punchline to this story, the piece that they sing is the Largo, movement number 2, from Dvorak's New World Symphony, number 9. And many of you know that symphony. It's one, it's traditionally one of the world's favorite symphonies. It's always topping the polls. It's a beautiful piece of music. And everyone recognizes this. And the power of this concert is so great that the Japanese prison guards go to the barracks where this concert is happening to check up on what's going on. And they go in. They don't shut down the concert. They sit down and listen to the concert. And at the very end of this performance, this a cappella wordless choir, they're not singing any language, it's just all la's and o's. At the very end of this concert, the Japanese guards stand with the rest of the prisoners and applaud the performers. It's a remarkable story. And what happens is they're able to continue these concerts throughout 1944, but eventually they have to stop because there are too many members of the choir who do not survive the camps. And Margaret Dryburgh herself also does not survive the war. She dies in 1945, shortly before Sumatra was liberated. And she's buried in a Dutch cemetery on the island of Sumatra. But it's a testimony not just to the heroism of Margaret Dryburgh, but also to the heritage of a composer of Antonin Dvorak, that he would be able to write this incredible music. A good movie to rent, which tells this story, is Paradise Road. It stars Glenn Close. It was put out in the mid-90s. And it kind of over-accentuates the brutality of the Japanese, but it does tell the story relatively faithfully. And as I was researching this, I discovered something interesting, a local angle to this, and neither Art nor I knew this when I found this out. But one of the survivors of the prison choir emigrated after the war to the United States. And she landed in all places of Menlo Park. And she and her sisters had managed to save, after the liberation, their manuscripts from the choir. And they donated them in 1980 to the Stanford Music Library. And the existence of these manuscripts became known then to various chorale groups. And in fact, the Peninsula Women's Choir actually held a concert in 1985 where they performed many of the works that Dryburgh had transcribed. Beethoven, Schubert Lieder, they did the Largo from the New World. And they were also able to locate, I believe, 9 survivors of the choir and bring them to Palo Alto as honored guests. Anyway, it's a testimony to the power of music, the fact that you could have something like that happen in war, have opposing people come together even for a short time. So this is the music that Dvorak is able to write. I think you'll enjoy the Sixth Symphony tonight as well. And so now I'll hand it back to Art, and he will tell you about Meistersinger.
Wagner. little response is, I love the music, but I hate Wagner. I don't like the music, but I hate Wagner. Or, I've never heard the music. Who is Wagner? We don't hear a lot of Wagner for several reasons. Most of the music that is performed today is his, one of his 10 operas. And to see a Wagner opera, you just don't walk in off the street and sit down and say, that's nice. The history of opera is such that in Italy, 100, 150 years ago, no TV, no theater, no radio. You want music? Either make it yourself or you go listen to it. And going to hear the Italian opera for the Italians is like going to Saturday morning, Saturday afternoon movies. Everybody knew the operas. But with Wagner, even in Mozart's time, he wrote very little opera in German. Still, in Austria and Germany, the Italian operas were the ones that were done. And if you wrote operas and you were German or you're Austrian, you wrote in Italian. So it took von Weber and eventually, especially Wagner, to write German music, German stories, German language. This is rather recent in the history of opera. Wagner lived at a very volatile time in Europe. 1848 was a big important date. A lot of political unrest, and he was a very much a political person, and so got himself into all kinds of trouble. For 11 years, he was living in Switzerland. Everybody had to get out of any place they went to Switzerland. So he's living in Switzerland for about 11 years. It took him a long time for it to get back to Germany. And he had failure after failure after failure. He was constantly in debt, constantly being loaned florins, which he never paid back. He had a very checkered married life. Two or three wives, two at least. Some children born before he was married, some after. But his idea of an opera is to bring all the arts together in a music drama. Not just the music, not just the words, but art and dance, everything all together as of a piece. Now with a Mozart or the Italian, operas, they were in chunks. You have an aria, you may have an ensemble, you may have a dance, but there were spaces in between. And sometimes there would be just a Singspiel where you don't sing, you just talk on the stage, and then you break into song for whatever reason. Wagner thought that was terrible. So he would start a movement or an act. And at least through one scene, the music would never stop. And what's going on is he is assigning motives, called leitmotives, for every person that's going to be on the stage, for the idea, the feeling, the philosophy, and what's going on is in the music. And you really have to pay attention and remember what's been played before so you can understand the opera through the music. The fact that it's on the stage, if you're just looking for the stage and getting it there, you don't get it. You have to know the music. So you don't walk in cold to a Wagner opera. You have to study it. And you have to bring pad because it's going to be 5 hours long. Maybe sometimes a long intermission. Der Meistersinger was the next to the last opera he wrote. All his operas, eventually, I mean, certainly through the Ring, were composed in this amorphous, everything-to-everybody style. But in Der Meistersinger, he went back to the old style of writing. Let me read you from my notes, or from notes about this. It is a far different Wagner we meet in Der Meistersinger, the master singers, than in The Ring or Tristan and Isolde. Der Meistersinger is Wagner's only comedy, and it's pretty heavy comedy, as you might expect. With his supreme command of musical resources and his infallible instinct for the theater, Wagner created a work whose salient features are humor, gentleness, glowing warmth, and joyfulness. In Die Meistersinger, we are no longer in the world of gods and legendary heroes, but in the world of human beings whose problems are those of the real world. The world of success and failure, symbolized by the song contest, because there's going to be a contest in the opera. A world in which there is both frustrations for Hans Sachs and fulfillment for the male and female leads, Walter, who sings his prize song, and Eva, his love. There is a human quality here that we find nowhere else in Wagner. It appears not only in the remarkable text, but in the radiant score, which often reminds us of old German chorales of street songs and lute songs. Music was not really his first bit of expertise. He wrote. He was a great reader, majored in literature in his own mind, and he wrote the whole book, the whole libretto, to The Ring, four operas, before he started writing the music. It took 20 years later to finally put the music to it. For a lot of reasons, there was a lot of problems in trying for him to get pen on paper, but much of it was political. Der Meistersinger, completed in 1867, came 8 years after Tristan and Isolde, and more than a decade after the first two dramas of the Ring cycle. Thus was conceived and completed, and Wagner's ideas about the music dramas were fully crystallized. In some respects, Der Meistersinger represents a retreat from these ideas. It returns to the older concepts of opera, with its formal arias, ensemble numbers, choral numbers, processional march, dances, and so forth. But the integration of these operatic elements is achieved with such skill, and the various elements are so essential to the dramatic context, that Wagner's basic concept of opera as a synthesis of all the arts is still realized. When you hear the overture, you're going to hear many melodies. I'm amazed in researching Wagner's musical upbringing as to how little he really had. He took out a book on theory and learned that, and he studied with a couple of people. But his ideas, he'd go to a university and quit after a year or so, as he couldn't stand what he was being taught. But you're going to hear 4 or 5 melodies at the same time. Somewhere he learned counterpoint, melody against melody. All these melodies you eventually will hear, if you can keep track of them and listen to all 4 or 5 at the same time, it isn't just a melody with boom, chick, chick, boom, chick, chick, as you might find in a Rossini opera. It's very complex, extremely listable. All the melodies, of course, are in the same key, because we haven't gotten out of tonality yet. And you're going to hear Walter's prize song, because this is the song that wins the contest. And if he wins the contest, he wins the girl, Eva. And that's what happened. So, I'll give you your chance, because we'll start off the concert with the Die Meistersinger Overture. Overtures evolved from just being crowd pleasers to settle the crowd before the opera starts, and then, therefore it doesn't matter what's going on in the music, because it has nothing to do with the opera, to overtures that expose the major themes that you might be hearing, and occasionally, even in a Mozart opera, the overture will go and will go right into the first act without a break. It won't stop. This is sort of anticipating Wagner's ideal. But we're going to stop the overture, and you'll hear five horrendous chords, and then you can applaud.